young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own, and I know how it feels to have wings on your head.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
On that street, on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry.
Jim Wood is with us. He's the author of From Ramen to Riches, Building Wealth in your 20s. He's the oldest of nine children, award-winning author. Jim Wood is a natural coach and a mentor. His mission is to share his passion for personal finance by increasing financial literacy, especially for those aged 18 to 30 years old who can most benefit from this knowledge. He retired from his job at age 47 after 25 years in high tech. He held positions as a software engineer, information technology manager, business strategy manager, and he earned a bachelor's degree in psychology with distinction from Boston University, holds a master's degree in engineering management from Stanford University. And let us say, Jim, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I remember San Diego, Jim, when it was a sleepy little town of about 45 to 50,000.
Well, it's a bustling town of a little over a million now. It's grown quite a lot.
I know, it's big. Let me ask you this. From Ramen to Riches, Building Wealth in Your 20s, what triggered you to really look into this subject to say there's a need here and they've got to learn?
Well, you know, I was the poster child myself when I was in my early 20s of what not to do. I was a financially clueless 20-something 30 years ago, and I did a lot of boneheaded things with my money at that time. And in the years since then, I've become passionate about financial literacy and wrote From Ramen to Riches because I wanted to help people avoid the mistakes that I made during that period of my life.
Now, by the way, in that period of life, I want to ask you how old you are, but if you go back a certain amount of years, did money hold the same definition as money holds today? Did we look at money the same as today at the time you were in your 20s and growing up?
Well, you know, I had a great job as a software engineer, and I was an impoverished college student for 4 years, so I kind of went nuts for the first 4 or 5 years after I had a paycheck and learned how to fly, learned how to scuba dive, and traveled a lot, and didn't really pay attention to my bank balance. And my financial epiphany came with a meeting with a mortgage banker. I was looking to buy a townhouse with a buddy of mine, and my friend had come up with a 20% down payment, and I borrowed my half from him. And the banker was looking at my application and looked up at me and said, "You mean to tell me you've been working in high tech for 5 years and your net worth is $500? And so that was both enlightening and embarrassing at the same time. So I resolved to figure out how to better manage my money and got pretty good at it and became a game. And I've been really passionate about trying to share that knowledge with people who might benefit.
You know, I go back a lot of years, and I remember when I first left home, I was 20 years old when I left home. And all the way through, you know, from junior high school, and whatever the case may be after that, I didn't even know what a checkbook was. My mother never discussed finances with us. I had no idea what was in the bank, and who cared what was in the bank? It was her job to pay the rent, quote unquote, and keep that mortgage going. So there are those times when kids really don't know what it is until they get hit with that first, you owe this, or you're late here, or you've spent too much money there. And by that time, it's not really too late. It's never too late, but that's when the shock hits.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's amazing to me that personal finance isn't a required subject for all high school students. When you think about it, we're sending young adults out into the working world and asking them to be good at balancing budgets, dealing with credit cards, managing student loan debt, making investment decisions for their 401ks at work, and so on. And all that without any sort of academic background on what all this stuff means and how to deal with it. And so, you know, in my mind, that's really not a recipe at all for success.
You know, we live our life based on definitions. If you have a definition of something and I have a definition of something and there's two different definitions on the same thing, usually we have a problem in communication. And I think that's what happens with money also. Now, time value of money, and you address this. What are we dealing with? How do we define that?
I do. And, you know, this is a particularly important concept for people who are young to really get, because it's the one asset that they have over people who are even slightly older. And that's the benefit of time in terms of the ability of your money to compound and get even larger over time. And so here's a real-life example for you. If you are 20 years old right now, all it takes is $4.25 a day, $4.25 a day, invested at the average stock market return over 50 years, you'll be a millionaire. Hmm. Now, that same person, if they wait until they're age 30, the same amount required to get that result goes up to $300 a month. And when you're age 40, it goes up to $700 a month. And so, you know, for many people who are in their early 20s, coming up with $4 a day shouldn't really be too much of a stretch.
No, not at all. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that we look at when we do that over a period of time is where to put that money. You know, you can put it in a bank, and there was a day where you could get a decent interest rate out of the bank. That doesn't really happen anymore. And the markets are so confusing today, they're almost scary because you never know where they're going to go from one minute to the next. So, Jim, what do we do? How do we tell them to take that $4 and change a day and where to put it?
Well, one of the concepts that I talk about in From Ramen to Riches is this notion of understanding your risk profile. So, you know, as you alluded to, there are some people who will lose sleep if they only lose a dime of their hard-worked money, and so they are more content to put it in a bank and don't want to take that risk, and that's fine. Other people are more willing to take higher risks in the hopes of potentially higher returns, and so there's that tension that goes back and forth between the desire for risk and safety and the desire to see your wealth grow over time. And so, you know, if to use the same example, if you're earning 3% in a bank CD, again, starting at age 20, it takes, I believe, about $700 or $725 a month to get that same result, $1 million, by the time you get to age 70. And so what people need to think about is where they fall in that risk-reward spectrum and decide, you know, how much am I willing to move into stock and bond funds, and how much would I rather keep in something safer like a bank account?
Jim, one of the biggest problems that we have today, especially when the youngsters get married, divorces are major. They're 50, 55% of the first-year marriages end up in divorce. And a great percentage of them are divorced because of money. Nobody ever thinks when you fall in love with somebody to sit down and say, how do you define money? What is money to you? And if you can get on the same wavelength, that same plane is what money means, for both of you, you stand a chance. But there are people who just don't think about it. I think money's this way. She thinks money's that way. And when it comes down to it, and everybody's in trouble, then the big problem starts. So right up front is, how do you define it? What does money mean to you? Where should it be? And I think a lot of problems would be eliminated before they even started.
I think it's a really good point, Michael. And, you know, not both for couples, but as well as for single people, what are the life goals and how does money fit into that? And so in one of the chapters in From Ramen to Riches, I talk about your life vision and your money philosophy. And so what that really refers to is, thinking about what you want over the next 10 or 15 years, in terms of your dreams, your goals, your aspirations, and what you want to do with your life, and doing that together with your life partner if you're married, and then taking a step back and say, okay, given all these things that I'd like to do or we'd like to do, where does money fit into that equation? So if you want to live a pretty simple life and live in a small town where expenses are relatively low, then your financial profile, your money needs, are going to be a lot different than somebody who, for example, wants a vacation home and wants to travel and buy a nice car. So by taking the time to think about that and writing it down on paper that you can either think about for yourself or talk about together with your spouse can really help figure out how are these things all going to mesh together.
So realistically, when we are dealing with credit and let's say the consequence of credit, they have to learn also what a credit card is. A credit card is not, oh, it's plastic, it's not money. Go to Vegas, they're chips, that's not money. And I think people get confused. When they get that plastic credit card, it's easy to buy something because the cash is not sitting in their hand. And let me add something else to that. And I've noticed that in markets. You can always tell about how old somebody is because very rarely do people use cash when they're paying something coming out across the counter. And you get the youngsters and you hand them a $100 bill, a $50 bill. They have trouble counting it back. And I think that in and of itself is a problem.
Yeah, and credit cards in particular can be super, super dangerous. In my mind, think about what might constitute good debt and what might constitute bad debt. So in my mind, there are really only two things that might be worth thinking about going into debt on. And number one is a reasonably sized mortgage on your house because you have the potential to build some equity over time. And then secondly might be student loans to help you get a college degree in the hopes of getting a better job. So everything else in my mind is bad debt, and in particular credit card debt. If you read the fine print on the card, you can be paying well in excess of 20% on the balance that you don't pay in full every month, and that's a crazy amount of interest. And so I really, really encourage people to make sure that they're fully paying off their credit card balance every month, and if they can't do that, then as you mentioned earlier, maybe it's better to go back to a cash payment system. Because that way, when the cash is gone, you know it's gone and you can't buy any more stuff.
True. Jim, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. It's www.fromramentoriches.com.
And can we buy the book there?
Yes, or you can go directly to Amazon.com or any major bookseller carries the book as well.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael. Really enjoyed it.
Take care. Good night.
There's so many exciting, wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? When there are so many fabulous, faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Corey Blake with us. He's the co-author of Overcoming Post-Deployment Syndrome, A Comprehensive Guide for Soldiers and Their Families. He's an authorized continual movement teacher, music and movement therapist at the Hunter Holmes McGuire Polytrauma Rehabilitation Center in Richmond, Virginia. And let us say hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. And thank
Michael,
you so
good.
Much. Yeah. And Corey, thank you so much for being here. There's so many of the kids that go over there don't know what they're going to get into, and who can? I don't care what kind of combat training you get until you're right there face-to-face with it. There's no way that anybody can explain it. And the kids get it, and they come back, and then there's problems. But I have a question. With the research that you've done and the work that you've done with everybody, is there anything at all during training that can help maybe to dilute this problem with the kids coming back?
Well, first I'd like to ask, is Dave on the phone there?
Yes, Corey, I'm on the phone as well.
Sorry. Okay, there we go. So, I would say that one of the things that the military is doing now is starting to incorporate some of these training techniques. I mean, so this is actually starting to come to pass, that they're not just sending them over there the way, just training them for war. They're training them to deal with the inevitable stresses that will show up as a result of this. So a lot of the training that we're suggesting, mindfulness training, breathing training, is already being incorporated by the military. It's coming along slowly, but I think they're learning some tricks as to how to help these guys before.
And let me do an intro to also David X. Sifu is the Herman J. Flax Professor and Chairman, Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Executive Director, Center for Rehabilitation Sciences and Engineering at the Virginia Commonwealth University, National Director, Physical Medical Rehabilitation Program Officer, Veterans Administration Central Office, and that's the Veterans Health and Administration in Richmond, Virginia. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Mike. How you doing?
Oh, I'm good, and thanks for being here. Let me ask you this. Is there an overarching theme with some of the problems the kids come back with?
Yeah. I would say the overarching theme is the theme we've seen in every major conflict, and that is, you know, it's more than just a physical injury. There are psychological injuries that compound and layer on, and that's been going on for thousands of years. But more and more of it now because we're aware of it, and we're seeing war at its fullest with the current conflict. So we're seeing that overarching aspect, the psychological overlay linking in with physical injuries, brain injuries, amputations, fractures, and that combination is a bad one.
Okay, let me ask both of you this, and this is a question, not a judgment, because I don't know the answer to this, so it's a question. I'm a former Marine. I went through boot camp in 1960, so it was quite a number of years ago. And from what I understand with the Army in the later years, in the 60s, 70s, etc., they had a timeout program that if they got too stressed, they'd pull out the timeout card and everything had to stop. And then when they got it back together, that they would continue on. Is this, from both of your perspective, is this kind of training, and Corey, let's go to you first with this, is this kind of training, does that set something up whereby they're not trained to handle emotionally what's out there? And that's a question now, not a judgment.
Well, you know, I'm not familiar with exactly what the program was in the 70s with the military, but I would say that really almost any training is going to affect the war is still going to have an effect on people. Now, not everybody who comes back is really as scarred or wounded, but some people, no matter how much training they had beforehand, are going to have a tough time with it. All we can do is minimize that. War is a horrible thing, and as much as these guys are trained to work with it, it wears heavy on them. It's a heavy toll. So I wouldn't venture to whether or not the training they're getting now is different from the training they're getting then. Dave might have something to say about that.
You know, Dave, let me frame it in a different way. There was a world that I came from. If you got knocked down, you bled a little bit, you got back up, you laughed it off, and you moved forward for the most part. Now, in the world today, if you get knocked down, you bleed a little bit, the counselor is there, and there's a tremendous amount of quote-unquote support and so on and so forth. And this is kind of the base of the emotional strength that a lot of kids go in with. Is could that in and of itself, and again, it's just a question, could that in and of itself have an effect on how they experience what they experience in a combat situation?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And you know, the answer is you know, what they bring in into the conflict, how their issues are for them, coming from and after, is vital. And so, yeah, I think that there's some folks that are having challenges with sort of kind of the new generation, the you know, and the, through it, we're quickly moved up. And whereas nowadays, it's some.
You know what, Dave, we're losing you a lot. Corey, is he breaking? Do you? Yeah, just lost him. Corey, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Yeah, there was a bad connection. I think he just got disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
Let me throw that question over to you.
Well, you know, I think the way I think of it is that one of these wars are, you know, what's going on now is guys are spending an awful lot of time in theater. I mean, they did in World War II and in Vietnam as well. But one of the things that's different is these improvised explosive devices, these IEDs.
Yeah.
Guys are driving around for days doing nothing but waiting to get blown up. And that has, you know, when you're ratcheted all the time, you know, the brain is on hyper fuel all the time, and you do that for a year. These aren't really psychological problems, they're physiological problems. The brain is really changed. That's one of the things that some of the modern science is letting us know, that these aren't, you know, literally the lower part of the brain continues to secrete the chemicals and electrical impulses that are perfect when you're in flight or fight mode. But
sure,
the brain won't turn these things off. And now I'm speaking particularly to PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. They used to think these were psychological, but these are really physiological problems. They manifest as psychological problems, but they're really physiological. So I'm not so sure, and I also think that in some previous wars, a lot of this maybe was covered up a little more. I think that was the case in World War II, the quote-unquote good war. There was a lot of people, my father for one, I never heard him speak of the war. And I think that this had a much more devastating effect, but I think guys just kind of kept it to themselves a little more. Maybe our culture is a little more open to this kind of thing. I don't know. It's a difficult question to answer, Michael.
Realistically, let me tell you what I just heard you say, which is an interesting point. And maybe we could get a fix to this thing. What I heard you just say is that, Corey, that the problem is a chemical problem. Once you go into fight or flight, there's, you know, there's obviously an adrenaline rush, and you go away from the central nervous system and you get into the autonomic nervous system. That's that unconscious system. Now, when you were talking about, now I can see where the tie into what you were talking about as regards to mindfulness and quieting down. When you go into that fight or flight syndrome, you've got the two pieces of the autonomic nervous system. You got the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system kicks up because it's going to protect you. The parasympathetic nervous system slows you down, brings you back to balance.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and so what I'm hearing here is the chemicals that would cause the parasympathetic nervous system to move into action aren't happening. And what they're doing, the mind is thinking to combat the pressure that they had. The chemicals are working in the mind, and it's causing them to continuously be in that flight syndrome.
That's exactly right, flight or fight. You know, so it's kicking out all different types of chemicals, cortisol, adrenaline, so that even when you're walking through a mall, regardless of what you're thinking, the body is continuing to feel or have the experience of being under threat. And there's also something that happens in the brain, in that the front part of the brain, the part that plans, the part that's conscious of things, is not conscious of what's happened in memory. It just knows that it's experiencing threat. And one
Corey, let me add something to that. It's conscious of what goes on in memory, but it's bringing, what is it? It's a conscious reconnection to what occurred, the experience that occurred, triggering the emotional reaction that we're having today. And I think that in and of itself is the problem. There, the point is, and Dave, I know you're back. And the point is where is it that we can get that balance to bring them into today? Because from what I'm hearing you say, Corey, they're reacting to something that occurred in the past. And yet, as far as the mind is concerned, it's going on today. And let me tell you how critical that this is. Let's say that you fell in love with a woman 10, 15 years ago, and she dumped you, and she really hurt you. You're standing in a room, and you see a woman that kind of looks like her. Or maybe she had the same smile. Or maybe she was built the same way. You go right into fight or flight, because the moment that you see it, you get the chemical reaction, and you were either resisting it, or nothing's happening. And I think that's what's going on. So if there is a disconnect and there's a chemical disconnect, wouldn't, and I'm not a clinician, guys, but wouldn't it make sense if we could find a way to compensate for the chemicals, to bring them into now as opposed to the past?
Well, the chemicals really aren't related to the past. They're happening right now in the brain of the PTSD difficulty. Maybe the cause is in the past, but what's happening in the brain is happening now. So it's not just a memory. Now, it requires memory to hook into this, and that was what makes this so difficult, because when you hook into the memory of what happened, that actually causes more threat. So you have to go into this very, very slowly. It takes a long time to work with this. Time itself is very helpful. But it really takes a good therapist, and then you're right about the chemicals. There are some pharmaceuticals out there that they're starting to work with that are very helpful, and Dave would have more to say about that, I think.
Yeah, and Dave, before you do, what we're talking about here is an unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association, and then it triggers a reaction or some kind of a response. And we lost him again.
Well, okay. That's a shame. He's a really brilliant, brilliant man. I hope you can get on and talk with him for a while. He's the national director of all the VAs in the country. He's a really brilliant man.
Well,
what I would say to you about this, Michael, is that working with, it really is, the brain is stuck in overdrive. So this is not just a function of memory. The brain has literally been changed, and that's what makes this so difficult and what makes it so important to understand, because in the military, the idea of suck it up and drive on is paramount, certainly to the mission. But when you get home and so forth, this is not something that can be sucked up, because you're driving around constantly with that in the mind, and it really has nothing to do with memory. That doesn't mean that hearing a car backfiring or something won't elicit an immediate response that's more intense. But you're basically living with a system that thinks it's under threat all the time. So,
Corey,
it's
let me hold you up. Let me do two things. Let me hold you up, because we're running out of time. I'm going to have Susie Greenman reschedule you guys. Radio Susie will get a hold of you, and we'll get you both on, because I think what you're talking about is extremely important. And let me add this to the mix here before we go. Corey Blake, what you're talking about happens in relationships all the time. What you're talking about happens to almost everybody, but it's such a lesser degree that they're not traumatized to it. So what we're dealing with is not just what's going on with the kids coming back. It's everybody.
Well, yeah, but post-traumatic stress disorder is a diagnosable thing where the brain is changed to such a profound degree that without an awful lot of work, it's not just going to be. It's not like breaking up from a love affair. It really is. It's something different. There may be some components to it that are the same, but seeing your buddies killed, seeing children maimed, seeing yourself maimed, losing your identity because you've lost your legs, these are not normal everyday occurrences. I really want to stress that, and because it's really easy to start to think, well, these guys will get over it over time, the way people – it requires a lot more work than that, particularly the way things are now and the length of the tours that these guys experience.
Sure. Now, Corey, we got to go. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Well, you can. I tell you what, you can find us on. You can. This is all about a book called Overcoming Post Deployment Syndrome, and I would suggest people look at that. Look that up. It's on. You can find it on Amazon. Overcoming Post Deployment Syndrome, which addresses really all of the symptoms of coming back from war, not just PTSD. And you can find that at your local bookstore as well. So that's where I would direct your attention for this. That would be the crux of what we have to say about it. And I'm looking forward to talking with you again, Michael.
Wonderful. Hey, Corey Blake, thank you so much for the work that you're doing and the time you spent.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Sharon is with us. Sharon is with us.
Hello?
Hello?
Come and sing a simple song, freedom. Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sharon Lecter with us. She is the author of Outwitting the Devil, The Secret to Freedom and Success. And as a matter of fact, she's the co-author of The 3 Feet from Gold and the co-author of the international bestseller Rich Dad, Poor Dad and 14 books in the Rich Dad series. She's also a national spokesperson for the National CPAs Commission on Financial Literacy and the founder of Pay Your Family First. And let us say, Sharon, hi, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Outwitting the Devil, The Secret to Freedom and Success. Is there the secret that's buried or maybe right there at the surface and we don't see it because we don't know how to recognize it?
Well, it's exactly what the book is all about. So many of us, we read books or we go to seminars, we know what we need to do to become successful, and yet we don't realize the success we deserve. And Outwitting the Devil was written by Napoleon Hill just the year after he wrote Think and Grow Rich, which, of course, is the foundational work of personal development and success. And in Think and Grow Rich, he lays out the principles of success, what you need to do to create success in your life. The very following year, in 1938, he sat down and said, okay, I'm troubled. I've written this thesis of success, and yet people will still not become successful because their own self-limiting beliefs, those things that we have inside us, that fear that keeps us from doing what we know we should do. And so he sat down and wrote Outwitting the Devil in 1938, and it was very provocative. He took on every taboo of its time. He took on religion, education, politics, sex, alcohol, cigarettes. He didn't leave any taboo unturned, and it scared his wife to death. So the book was hidden for over 70 years, and yet it truly was written for today.
Now, by the way, I know he was a forward thinker. 1963, this is our secret now. I was 21 years old, and I went to work for Lincoln National Life Insurance in Beverly Hills, California. And the agent, Norman Bluebon, I mean, we're talking about 50-some-odd years ago now. Norman Bluebon, I walked in, and he hired me, and he started putting me through the training. And you know what the first thing he put in my hands was?
Think and Grow Rich.
Absolutely. And that was my first book. He said, you read this and then we'll talk. And I read it and moved from there. But Napoleon Hill, when he did what he did, what was it that transcended to outwitting the devil? When they didn't understand it, they didn't listen to him, they kept not taking what he was saying and staying in the lives that they had. What was that bridge? What was the secret that Hill found to allow people to move forward and think beyond what they think they can think?
Well, part of it is understanding the things that happen to us as young people that may define us or may it be innate inside how we react to certain things. I'm sure some of your listeners can think about times when they've reacted to something and they, whoa, where did that come from? Or they've said something and wanted to pull it back. So many of us have things in our past, whether it be our religious upbringing. You know, in the book, Outwitting the Devil, he talks about, was your religious upbringing made through fear or through faith? And, of course, I can remember ministers in my youth that scared me to death, and I can still think of them today and shiver in fear. And yet I also remember those ministers that I had who lifted me up and made me feel like I could be and do anything I wanted to do. So that was part of what he contrasts in this book is think about your own educational upbringing. Were you brought up in a spirit of fear, or were you brought up where you could experience and love learning and become a problem solver? And so he takes on all of those elements, and he starts at the beginning about winning the devil, and he shares his own issues that many of us that have studied him all our lives didn't know. He talks about those deep, dark moments in his own life when he felt that he was a fraud, when he was a failure, where he, you know, here I am supposed to be the philosopher of success, and I've lost everything. And how he grabs himself up by his own bootstraps and redefines success and redefines himself. And so by doing that, as a reader, you become very enamored. You relate to him, and you understand that he was human just like the rest of us. And we have to learn from our failures, and we have to learn from those downturns and be able to create greater success in the future. And so Outwitting the Devil, then he has this epiphany one night, and he has an interview with the devil. And he says to the reader, it's up to you. You can think that this is the real devil, or you can believe this is that inner voice, that other self, that inner demon that talks to you and keeps you from becoming successful. It's up to you as the reader to define that. And then he goes in and he puts the devil on a witness stand and interrogates him about how he disrupts our lives. And, of course, the devil's number one tool is fear. And you can all think about it. If you live in fear, then you get easily swayed. You get off your course to success because you're in fear and you're paralyzed by that fear. And so in Outwitting the Devil, Napoleon Hill shows 7 steps to get past that fear.
No, by the way, what we're dealing with, there's 2 motivators that we have, emotional motivators, and they're unconscious. One's the fear of loss, and the other one, obviously, is the desire for gain. Fear is the most powerful motivator, a tool, let's call it a tool, that people have used to sell things, to maneuver people, to do whatever they're going to do. And you're right, when it came to religion years ago, a tremendous amount of fear. You don't believe this way, God's going to get you, you're going to go to hell. And people were frightened to death, and they moved in a particular way, and they let faith go away. Now, the marketing people, those who really knew how to motivate an audience to buy or move in a particular way, motivated with fear. And there's that old thing about the adage about thinking outside the box. We all think basically the same thoughts. You know, Sharon, they jumble around in your head, but they come out pretty much about the same way. But the idea is thinking outside the box is thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. Once you move to that, then you've changed your perspective. When you change your perspective, the thinking changes and your entire world is completely different.
Exactly, and you used a word at the beginning of what you were just saying, the subconscious mind. And that's what outwitting the devil helps you reveal. It helps you understand those certain things that may happen, be innate in your being, in your own personality, that is subconscious, that keeps you holding yourself back from creating the success in your life. And once it's revealed, you can deal with it and get past it. This, you know, as you said at the beginning when you introduced me, I've been involved in a lot of incredible books. I've had the honor to build the Rich Dad brand. I've been honored by the Napoleon Hill Foundation to work on 3 Feet from Gold. But I can honestly say out of the 17 books I've been involved in, this is truly the most profound manuscript I've ever had anything to do with. It was profound in my own life and profound in everybody that reads it. People say, this is exactly what I needed right now. This is what helped me get past. I now understand what's been holding me back.
By the way, I know why he hid it for 70 years. It's very obvious. If he put the devil on trial, quote unquote, he was putting himself on trial. And if you go back all of those years and you try to tell somebody that that something inside of them, they are the devil that's keeping them back, that they would never have accepted that at the time in the culture.
That's so true. And quite frankly, if it had been released back then, we probably wouldn't have seen the success and the profound impact of Think and Grow Rich. Truly, Think and Grow Rich was the right book for the time in 1937. And certainly close to over 70 million of them have been sold around the world. And truly, that's the book that really helped us get out of the Great Depression. Today, the right book for today, with the fear that's going on in the markets right now, certainly demonstrated today, we need something that's a little more provocative. We need something to wake people up, to get them out of the paralysis and to start taking action and turn that fear from paralyzing them to motivating them, as you just said. Get that motivation to keep working and to start creating the success in your life. And you may, every page you turn, every time you read it, there's a new message that applies specifically for where you are today and how to get to where you want to go.
Well, now, by the way, let me give you what I've heard you say so far. Let me paraphrase in my own way. That the secret here, the major secret, is when you take a look at what's going on in your life and you realize that you're the one who's created the fear based on what you heard. If you're the one that's created the fear, if you created it, you can change it. But if you allow that somebody else did it to you, then you're completely controlled and you follow along, you become an automaton. And I think in today's world, we're beginning to realize that if anything's going to happen in our life, we have to be able to admit that we are responsible for everything that happens. We're responsible for our emotions and nobody else did it to us.
That's so true. And part of this book, what happens in today's world is so many of us, we define ourselves through other people's eyes. We define ourselves by how good a mother, how good a grandmother, how good a boss. But the whole concept of this book is that you must define yourself first. You must empower yourself. Look in the mirror and define success by what you see and create the future. And then you can become a better mother, a better grandmother, a better grandfather. It's so important that we take control of our own lives. And the biggest thing in the book that is so important for people today is that we have to move away from entitlement to empowerment and take control of our own lives. Napoleon Hill talks about drifters versus non-drifters. And a drifter is someone who can be easily swayed, goes with the flow, doesn't have that definiteness of purpose. And what happens is that that person is adrift all of his life instead of someone who knows what their ultimate goal is. A non-drifter, someone who's always on purpose. Yes, you may get pulled off course, but it's much easier to correct because you know where your end goal is.
I think Napoleon Hill really knew what the title of this book was. The title is not Outwitting the Devil. Sharon, the title is Outwitting Yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. When you really come down to it, yeah.
Getting yourself out of the way so that you can create success.
Sure. And it's based on what we think other people think the way we should be, their definition of perfection. At my best, at my optimum, Sharon, I can only be the second best you. I don't care how hard I try, but I've got to be the first best me. But if I spend my life trying to be the first best you, which is never going to happen for me, then I live a deluded life. And what he is saying, be who you are, outwit all of those things that you've been brought up to believe about yourself that you can't do. And once you outwit yourself, then the life opens up for you.
Absolutely. And and it's amazing. You know, Napoleon Hill himself said in Think and Grow Rich, what your mind can conceive and believe, you can achieve. And it's all of us understanding that we can realize our dreams if we start working towards it. And there's something else he introduces in the book called Hypnotic Rhythm. And it talks about that if you start controlling your environment, controlling how you spend your time, and start working towards your ultimate goal, it becomes easier and easier and easier, and then you're going to reach success much more quickly. When you define everything about your life towards your ultimate goal of success, you will achieve it.
Yeah, and it is a, and life is a rhythm. And when you're out of that rhythm is when the problem starts. When you're in the rhythm, you move through. And I really believe in all the years I've been on this planet that when things are going bad, when you can't seem to get it right, it's yourself telling yourself to sit down and take a look at what you're doing and stop resisting the world.
Yeah, you think about that little devil on your shoulder that's whispering in your ear, you're not worthy, you can't do it, you'll never win. That's the influence that's embedded in us, and many times that comes from things that happened as a child. And the first thing you need to do is confront it, realize it's there, and say, get rid of it. Just flick it off your shoulder and know that you are in control of your own destiny. If you want a different outcome, make different choices.
Yeah, by the way, there is something to offset the devil on your shoulder. Who was it? It was Paul Muni, middle to late 30s. There was a movie, and the movie was called Angel on My Shoulder. And basically, he died, he went to hell, and he came back to cause some problems. But at the same time, he moved, he did some changes. So to outwit the devil on your shoulder, there's two voices in there. One's the devil, that's the one you hear, but then there's a voice underneath it, and that's the angel. And it's
the angel's on your right shoulder, the devil's on your left. Keep the right shoulder angel in close and get rid of the devil.
Absolutely. And I think most of it is being mindful about it. If you don't think about it, it takes you over. If you think about it, your life becomes very intentional. I think the book is brilliant.
Well, thank you. It has been incredible. We've had such wonderful reviews, and people say, you know, this is exactly the book I needed to refer right now, today in my life. And the reviews we've had on Amazon have been incredible. We have a special website called outwittingthedevil.com. where you can download a secret chapter that was in the original manuscript but did not make it in the final book called outwittingthedevil.com. It's that secret chapter. But the other thing is people have talked about Michael Bernard Beckwith, a minister that was in The Secret. His afterward, he says this is going to create a renaissance in consciousness. On Amazon.com, we've had reviews that said this book is going to create a cosmic shift in positive outcomes. Now, don't you think as a world we need a cosmic shift in positive outcomes?
Yeah, and if we define cosmic, it's a total shift. It's coming externally and it's coming internally.
And it starts internal, and it starts with each of us taking control of our thoughts, taking control of our actions, taking control of our choices with definite a purpose.
No question about it. We are starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at and, Sharon, buy the book?
Absolutely. Outwittingthedevil.com is where you can get the secret chapter and buy the book. Or you can visit me at SharonLechter.com or my company, PayYourFamilyFirst.com.
Hey, Sharon Lechter, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated every second of it.
Well, thank you, and I really appreciate your thoughts and appreciate your support in spreading the word about this very important book.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey,
always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. David Welsh with us. He's the author of Legend Unborn, Book 1 in the Key of Soul series. It's a fantasy novel, and he currently works in the video gaming industry as a user experience specialist. And, David, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Nice to meet you.
Okay, and by the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about what we talk about, Legend Unborn, we're all kind of a legend in our own rights, in our own minds, and yet most people don't express it. Most people won't manifest what's inside, or they won't even look at the world around them, plus the world that they can't see. And you know, we live in closets. We don't want to open the closet up and take a look and see what's out there, because it might be too frightening. So let me ask you this. Working in the video gaming industry, did that set a base of what you decided to create Legend Unborn? Because life is a game.
That's actually a really good point. I mean, I happened to accidentally fall into the gaming industry after you know, quite a few years, but it's definitely helped my experience to write the book, because I'm involved in, you know, developing new worlds, creating new people, new experiences. So yeah, it's definitely had an impact on it.
Now, when you decided to put your ideas to pen, what created it? What was it that one night or one day, whenever it was, that you got that aha moment that said, oh, I have an idea here, and it started to create itself in such a way that you wrote it?
Well, it actually started as a short story. I wrote about 20 years ago, of all things. It actually got rejected because it was 800 words over the actual word limit. And but I actually got a personal letter from the organizer saying it was quite a fun story, and I said I should pursue it further. So I did, and yeah, 20 years later, it appeared. But as to what the inspiration was, I just love the underdogs. I mean, it's a book about the underdogs. That's the main thing in it.
Okay, the book about the underdogs. Now, obviously, you created it as a fantasy. When people do fantasy, there's no such thing as a fantasy, David. It's absolutely real. But when we frame it in such a way that it's a fantasy, it's easier for people to look at. So is that one of the reasons you did what you did?
I suppose so, yeah. I mean, that's an interesting way of looking at it, because, I mean, when I read fantasy books, I love being involved in the actual, you know, the worlds that the people have created. So, yeah, that's absolutely. I mean, to be able to, in my respect, I almost actually meet the people in the stories. I enjoy reading about their lives and to see how they expand and explore. So yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I've always, I have interviewed many, many authors over the years, And one of the things that I found is in some way, if you really sit down and you look at the subject matter, you find yourself. You find yourself in every one of the characters, and it's an external expression of what you hold inside. And I've watched this over the years, and no matter what it is, if you look at the book and you really get into the characters, you'll find yourself.
True. I suppose so, yes, because somebody's actually pointed that out, that quite a few of the characters do have some of my flaws and faults, as it were. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose in some ways we actually do it subconsciously as well. Maybe sure. We don't actually mean to do it, but maybe the characters do come across as, you know, manifestation of the actual author themselves. Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, yeah. There was a prime example of fantasy years ago with the Star Trek series. There was one particular episode that I guess Frank Gorshin, who was a bit player, I think he's passed away years ago now, but he came onto the starship, he came onto the Enterprise, and he was black on the left side, and he was white on the right side. And he was frightened to death because they were after him from the planet. They were going to kill him. Why were they going to kill him? Because everybody else was reverse black and white. So he was the odd guy out. And
right.
I think what they did was they put a real life issue in front of everybody, the prejudice and so on and so forth. But they put it in such a way that they made it look ridiculous so you could really see what was going on.
Right.
Yeah. Fantasy. There's no such thing.
I suppose so. I mean, now that you put it in that respect, yes, it's. Like I said, in my book, for example, I do take a lot of present day situations and try to make things, trying to put it into the context of the fantasy, and I also inject some humor into it. So yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Now, by the way, the main characters, what are they about? Right, and the main characters themselves. Did they all come out at one time, or did as you created a character, then somebody else popped up? How did it happen?
I had the idea for the two main characters. So the main character, there's three main characters. So the main characters are Sylvanas, Flyfar, and Taff. So the main character was actually, I wanted to create a book with animals in it as well. So Flyfar is an eagle who is actually afraid of heights, and Taff is a really, really powerful wizard, but he's never been able to cast a spell. So when I was working with those two together, I wanted also something to bounce off from those two. And this is where I created Sylvanas, who happens to be a god, with a newly created god with a stutter and a broken leg, and he's actually on a pair of crutches.
By the way, when you create this, and the character... Well, that was interesting. A crippled god.
Yes.
Yes, a crippled god. And was he physically crippled, or is that the symbolic interpretation of the inability for people to really touch what they believe in anymore?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I actually just thought it was actually quite funny, because we all hear about religion and God being, you know, all-powerful, all supreme. And I thought, well, let's take it a little bit step further and have something that's, you know, seriously flawed. So when he speaks, he has, you know, a slight stutter, but like I say, he has a broken leg, so he's on a pair of crutches, his left leg's in a plaster cast, and he also loves tea and biscuits.
Yeah. By the way, we just said the same thing.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the fantasy novels in and of themselves, there's something called a value proposition, a USP, unique selling proposition. Where does this novel, the Legend Unborn, how does it differ from everything else out there? When I pick it up and I read it page by page, cover to cover, David, what am I going to get out of it? What does Michael Ray walk away with? Why is it different?
Well, for me, I've tried to create it. So when I was a child, I used to read the fantasy novels, and I was always somewhat disappointed sometimes because, for me, they would never really go far enough into being the fantasy. They would always hold back a little bit. And a lot of them are also quite serious. There's always, like, some moral story that they seem to have to tell. So I tried to make things a little bit more extreme, really, really chaotic set pieces. I wanted people to come back and think, oh, man, you know, I really enjoyed reading that because it made me laugh, it made me cry. So it actually gives you a range of emotions as opposed to just setting them in the fantasy world. So I want them to be able to think, hey, yeah, you know, I had a good time reading that book, and I'm looking for, you know, I'd say looking forward to the next one.
Now, by the way, with the next book and in the series, how are you going to keep it flowing? When I say how are you going to keep it flowing, what are you going to use as the connectors?
That's actually a really good question, because I'm halfway through the second book at the moment, and I've actually started to find that writing the next in the series is actually much more difficult than writing the first one, because in the first one you're given a lot more freedom in some respects, because you have to create the characters, you have to create the settings. But in the second one, you've already got this, so now you have to try and fit them into the situations you want them to happen. So what I've had to do is I've had to link them all together. I know what happens at the end, I know what happens at the beginning, and I know what happens in the middle part. So linking them at the moment is a bit of a gray area. I'm getting there.
Yeah, and by the way, when you do this, do you ever get exhausted at the end of when you've written and you've got into it and you've thought it out and you've laughed and you've cried and you've done all these things and you've had all of your emotions into it? Have you ever got to a point where you're just exhausted at the end of the writing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have to do this when I come home from work as well. So physically, I'm already a little bit tired, but I always feel if I can write a book and I feel tired because I've written it, I actually feel like I put so much into it, then I feel that's more worthwhile than just writing and feeling, you know, blasé about it. So, yeah, I do feel really exhausted after writing scenes, but I actually feel that's a good feeling.
You know, what's great about writing today, authors, for the most part, you know, people can go through their entire life and never really get to express. And when you decide to put something to pen, when you decide about whatever the subject is, when you decide to write about it, that's going to live longer than you will. And in essence, what this is also, David, it's your legacy.
True. And that's one of the things that when I was reading up about, in, you know, simple things regarding copyright, is I said, oh, the copyright will exist 75 years after your death. And that sort of puts things into perspective as well.
Sure.
You know, we're thinking, I'm writing this book and I've already started reading about my death. So it's very poignant in some respects.
not a good thing. Okay.
Not a good thing, no, absolutely.
Yeah, but what it really comes down to, people think about their deaths, but when you really, really think about it, it's called, sometimes it's a wake up to get alive and be alive. And what are you going to do until you die? And most people have no idea. And I think it's great when you decide to put something to pen, you become an author. Now you've got that something to do that most people don't have.
True, and I've bumped into quite a few people, and they tell me, oh, I wish I could write a book. And the first thing I tell them is, well, do it. You know, why just say I wish I could when you're more than able to pick up a pen, make notes, and go for it? You know, I see people far too often, they get caught up in their lives, get caught up in their work, and not just take the time and think, okay, if I want to do something, and then I can, you know, a little simple thing like writing a book, writing a short story. Just go ahead and do it, you know?
No question about it. We're starting to run out of time. Now, let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. So the website about the book is www.keyofsouls.com. And I also have a blog up, which is www.worksofdgwelsh.com.
Wonderful. Hey, David, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
No, thank you, Michael. Thank you so much. And I must admit, this is my first ever interview, so thank you so much.
Oh, you did good. Okay, thanks for being here.
Thank
good
you.
Good night.
Good night now. Bye-bye.
Japan and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oasis. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there, so tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Stan Kordetsky with us. He's the author of Decisive Reform for Our Dying Healthcare System, has practiced and taught clinical family practice over 25 years now, has been a chairman of two different managed healthcare communities, including Physician Corporation of America, a managed care company representing 300,000 people. And let us say, Stan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Dresser. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we look at the healthcare today, obviously there's a tremendous amount of confusion. I'm going to go right back to, and I'm not getting political with this, but I'll go right back to Nancy Pelosi and the famous statement of, don't worry about what it says, you'll find out afterwards.
And yeah, that's
true. That in and of itself talks about what we are looking at in healthcare, and it's causing a major problem with a tremendous amount of the doctors in practice today, because if healthcare costs go the way it looks like they're going to go, there's a lot of doctors who won't be in business.
That's true.
So what? So the purpose of the book, what did you do? What caused you to sit down and put this information to pen?
Well, I started doing emergency medicine as a medical student back in 1961. And I did emergency medicine and family practice for 25 years. I got so frustrated, this was back in the 70s, the way insurance was going, so I started a little tiny health plan, little tiny HMO. People didn't even know what they were back then. Hmm. We saved so much money in it, and the patients were so happy, I made it go into a bigger one, and that was very, very successful. And so all of my life, I've been kind of an amateur health economist, never getting my PhD, but teaching courses in it. And basically, the way we used to, as most CEOs of health insurance companies 30 years ago, were physicians. I know many of them that formed the companies. And the way they used to attack healthcare costs was the same way I did. You attack disease. But today, the government and insurance companies and Medicaid, instead of attacking the disease, they attack the patient and they attack the doctor. And disease goes unchecked.
Well, Stan, that, and very valid, obviously. There's no question about that. But what I'm seeing also, it's a reversible cause and effect. Doctors have been pushed into doing defensive medicine. You know, if you breathe wrong, somebody's going to sue you. You've got the attorneys there. The cost of malpractice is going up exponentially. And we are in a situation now where you have on, as a doctor, you have ongoing and continuous expenses. And if you have to raise your cost to be able to stay in business, who's going to suffer for it? The patient will. And that doesn't mean that it is the doctor who is doing this. You guys are forced into it.
You're exactly right. Malpractice costs the country about $80 billion a year. Of the $80 billion that are paid for by fees by hospitals and doctors, attorneys get 65% of that. The patient who's injured only gets 35%. It's also interesting, most patients that are genuinely injured, it takes them 3 to 4 years to collect, which is sad. My book calls for changing the malpractice crisis into being just like workers' comp. if someone's injured, it should be automatic. It shouldn't take 4 years, and it shouldn't make everybody feel so horribly guilty. Mistakes are made. They're made because we get so busy in the emergency room. Things are going everywhere, and patients get the wrong medicine occasionally because the nurses are so busy, and the patient in one room has the same name as the patient in another room. I've seen these things happen over the years. So medical malpractice costs about $80 billion. And it should cost about one-fourth that if we did it right, and the patient would get much better care.
But where is it that keeps that sustaining this? And when I say that, you know, if you look at the government, the administrations come and go, and the presidents and vice presidents and Congress people come and go. But what seems to stay constant is business. Business stays on focus. Business is looking for dollars. So if you look underneath it, you know the old adage, if you want to find a problem, you follow the money. But the old adage about that, if we really have to look too, where is the money going? Who is stimulating this kind of a program and walking away with a pocket full of money? If we find out who that is, and then we can get to the source of what's going on. Because I think, you know, I've read the press material. I think everything you're saying is spot on. I'm on your bandwagon. I mean, there's no question. But to get it stopped, where is, through your eyes, where's the challenges? Where's the roadblocks? Where is it that you get stopped from doing what is right to do?
You hit it right on the head. Many of the healthcare regulations that were started 30 and 40 years ago started for a good reason. Coding and billing was started to help control fraud. However, now coding and billing, they used to be only maybe having a few hundred codes. Now there are 66,000 codes, and it gives a pathway to fraud. Coding and billing, in my estimation, caused about an extra $200 to $250 billion a year that doesn't need to be there. If a doctor wants to cheat, all he has to do is code and bill correctly and document. It's not up to the ethics. So we've seen this happen. The government has caused this by the bureaucracy of raising coding and billing. So that costs us an extra $250 billion a year. The interesting thing is European outcomes, when you study death rate, maternal mortality, child mortality, you study that in Europe, they're slightly ahead of us in Europe and in Canada. However, their costs are almost half what ours are. Ours is twice as much, and yet we don't have as good outcomes. And that's a lot of it because of the bureaucracy. The second point that you made, where is taking the money? In 1995, I did some consulting for several governors and even Bob Dole when he was running for president. And we were looking at HIPAA. You know what HIPAA is now.
Sure.
HIPAA back then, what purpose was to create all medical records to be on a credit card. Since I had a company that had electronic medical records, we were just helping to show how it could be done so easily. It wouldn't have been complex. However, the Congress was for it. The Republicans were for it. The Democrats were for it. There was no opposition to creating HPA, Health Portability Act, HIPAA it was called. However, during the congressional hearings, one congressman, who was a famous womanizer, liked to have his picture in the paper with all his girlfriends, but he goes to an urgent care late at night, and the paparazzi follow him, and they find out that he's got some type of venereal disease. The paparazzi put that in the paper the next day. So, therefore, all of a sudden, HIPAA portability was changed to privacy. There's no more portability at all. That costs us approximately $200 billion a year. Doctors weren't the one that shared that information. Doctors have always tried to protect the privacy of patients. But we don't need to spend $200 billion a year to protect that congressman who got in trouble. And that's the way a lot of things have happened. And so someone finds a way to make money off of HIPAA, and there are companies that make money off of HIPAA. So you're exactly right. We use some bureaucratic technique, and someone makes a lot of money.
I'll give you a definition of a bureaucracy, and it's kind of an interesting thing that occurs with us. A bureaucrat is someone who's not elected. They are paid. They are hired to do a job, and then they go out of the realm of what their responsibility is. And that's what I think we find when you're dealing with the healthcare, when you're dealing with different organizations that need to be able to do the most that they can for the public at large, but you've got that wall. You've got that
You hit it right on the head. That's exactly right. Yeah.
It stops you from staying on focus, and it stops you from doing what you have to do. All right, now let me ask you this. Obviously, you've got the steps, you've got the methods to do it. But how do you personally, how can you move through these challenges that are put in front of you to get these things accomplished? And I think that it's a tough question, but we get an answer to that, and then we got a way to go.
You've hit it correctly. You're one of the few news people that have actually asked the right questions. I don't see it on television. I don't see the television people comment that why can we talk about everybody's sex life, but we can't talk about somebody having a runny nose, and that costs us $200 billion a year. I don't see the right people talking about it. And so I think we have to start talking, and we have to get news people to start making inquiries and asking questions, and I think that's the key. Then you will find leadership in Congress will listen to news people because that affects their voting.
Oh, by the way, that's exactly what it is. When it really comes down to it, it's who's going to vote for me, and I'm going to say what I have to say and do what I have to do to get that particular vote. When we say we have a corrupt government, it doesn't mean anybody's stealing. What that word corrupt means is it's broken. It's not sustainable. It doesn't give us what it was set out to do. And I really believe what went on in the last week or so should be a wake-up call, because that's health. That's everything that we deal with in our country.
You're exactly right. One of the plans that I've talked to people about, every congressman and senator ought to be on Medicaid. If they are on Medicaid, they would understand the problems and why the costs are so high. Medicaid costs could be much lower and have better outcomes if it was done right.
No question about it. And so we can talk, not we, but if we were elected officials, we can talk the talk, but we don't necessarily have to walk the walk. I go back to a time when the doctor came to the house with the little black bag. You know,
That's days, right.
Obviously are long gone today. But we have to deal with what we have to deal with now. And I really believe also that preventative medicine is probably the key to saving hundreds of billions of dollars. And it doesn't all have to be allopathic.
You're exactly right. And that's what I say in my book. The reason why we don't have preventive medicine today is, number one, not very many people pay for it. Government doesn't pay very much for it. If I do preventive medicine, I get paid maybe $30 or $40 an hour. If I do a procedure, I get paid $500 an hour.
Yeah. Okay, and that in and of itself, there's another area here that I was thinking about as you were speaking. There's also the fear factor. If I can control things, if I can hold things back, if I can say, if you do this, then you'll get that, then I've got a control over the population, and they're going to do what I want them to do. So healthcare at this stage of the game, this is what I see, Stan, that the healthcare at this stage of the game is nothing more than a tool to control the population.
I agree. And it's so sad because we see people die left and right because they don't have preventive care. It's interesting. They can go to Walmart or some of the other stores and get a prescription for preventive care for $4. And yet, they don't have the money to pay $100 to go to their doctor to get the prescription.
Yeah.
And so we see that happen. Where in Europe, a lot of those prescriptions are over-the-counter. That's what saves a lot of money, too.
Yeah, and by the way, with all due respect for somebody coming here from another country, if they're coming in here illegally is the operative word, they don't belong here. But for the most part, if you want something, if you want the best education, if you want the best health care, you sneak across the border and you get it. And I know it's a horrible thing that I just said, and there's no question about it. But there's validity to what just got said. All of this money that's getting spent on all of these things, what's going on is we're leaving the population at large. We're leaving them on the outside of the door. There's no protection. There's no respect. And if we're not very careful, we're going to have a herd mentality.
You're exactly right. I do emergency medicine still. We find that 75% of the emergency visits are unnecessary. It's because they can't see their primary care doctor. People without insurance, immigrants, can come to the emergency room and get free care. Americans can't.
because they get billed. But the immigrants, sometimes if they're illegal, you don't have an address for them.
Sure.
So they get free care, but Americans don't get free care.
No. And so somewhere it's got to stop. And I have no idea who's going to be strong enough to get in to stop. When I say who, it's not going to be one person, but it's going to be a collective thought. And when that collective thought gets together, maybe we can come back to be who we were. And when that happens, health care will be taken care of and everything will fall back into line. But if we move in the direction that we're moving today, it is not going to happen. And we are going to end up to be a Middle Eastern country. And that I do not want to see.
I can't agree with you more. I think you should run for president. I'll vote for you.
Oh, by the way, though, there's only one person that I would want to see as president, and I'm old school. President and vice president, Stan, should be John Wayne and the Fonz.
I agree with you. Let's wear our six gun and go for it.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Now, let me ask you this. What can we do? What can a listener do? What can the general population do to get behind you and help you here?
I think the biggest thing is the Congress, we're not going to listen a lot to a few voices, but I think if advertisers, and we'll tell the radio stations, the television stations, hey, let's look at this. Let's find a way to help our costs. The same advertisers have to pay very high costs for their employees' health care. They ought to tell the television people, hey, do a story. Do some stories. And what can we do about our health care costs? I think that's the way to do it. I think employees can tell their employer who's advertising with a television station or with public radio. Let's do some interviews.
We have to go back to basics,
though. Several people.
All right, but we have to go back to basics, though. And when I say basics, we live in a world of definition. You define something one way, I'll define it maybe a little different. And if it's the same thing and we have two different definitions, then we're never going to get anywhere. And I think the biggest problem that we have today, not just as a culture, but as a human race throughout the world, is we don't ask the right questions. And if we ask the wrong questions, we get the right answers to the wrong questions, we never get anywhere. But if we find out the right questions to ask, we begin to get the right answers, and then we get to put our foot on the path of getting something done. And I really believe if you were to ask 10 people out on the street, what is healthcare? You're going to get maybe six or seven different definitions. And unless we can get on the same page and define what it is that we're going to battle or what we want in the same way, there's got to be collaboration. And without that collaboration, we're never going to get anywhere. And that's what's going on right now. We are divided in every way, shape, and form. We're divided by the genders. We're divided by sexuality. We're divided by the races. This thing goes on and on. And if you want to destroy this country, you allow it to implode. And if it implodes, the only way that's going to happen is if it's divided in ideologies.
You're speaking very much what I agree. That's why I wrote my book, because I asked the questions in the book. And the questions can be asked to anyone. And I don't think you'll find very many physicians or hospital administrators to disagree with what I've said, in that we have to ask the right questions, and the questions have to come with the right answers, and people will have to have the right answers if the questions are asked. That's why I wrote my book.
Yeah, and by the way, we've got to get them out there to ask the questions, and I really believe if we say it in such a way that they recognize it. Not understand it. You can understand anything. It doesn't mean anything. But if you recognize it within your own world, then it gives you that impetus, that impetus, that strength to be able to move forward and get something done about it. So, all right, now, just writing to a congressman doesn't seem to do any good anymore. Besides buying your book, what can we do? What organizations can we join? Who can we get in contact with?
I think there are several national, there's some healthcare not-for-profits, but I think the biggest thing is for people. The advertisers are the one that will tell the radio and television stations the questions to ask. So I think if people will have their employer ask the questions who do the advertising, I think that will start the right thing to go, because the television industry lives on advertising. The politicians live on what the television news commentators say about them. They live or die by what comes out on the news. So
sure.
If the advertisers can put pressure on the news media to ask the right questions, I think the questions that you said are exactly right. We have to have questions that come back, and let then the news media will have different people like you, like me, and other people come on and discuss it. And they will say, well, hold it, what about this? How come it costs so much? Why is our cost twice as much as what Europe has, and yet our outcomes are less? I think those questions have to be asked over and over.
And there's a great way to control the advertisers, no question about it. Don't buy the product.
That's correct.
That's really what it boils down to. Okay, Stan, we're just about out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
I don't have a website. The book, I'm trying to get it with Ex Libris. Ex Libris is my publisher, and there's a website there called Decisive Surgery for a Dying Healthcare System under my name. So you might look www.decisivesurgeryforadyinghealthcaresystem.
Wonderful. And by the way, Stan, I'm not a web guy, but you need a little website just for people to come to and get involved in what you're talking about.
I think that's a good suggestion. I'm not that kind of a guy either, so I have to learn that. You know,
Those guys are hireable. Those guys are hireable. All right, hey Stan, we've got to go. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Enjoyed very much meeting with you too, Mr. Dresser. Have a great day.
Take care.
Stay healthy.
There isn't any more we've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
The evening we're new again. I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.